Okay. I put in some references just in case you want to do even more reading about the topic. Although you don't have to. Let me move this so I don't trip over it. Okay, so what I was thinking that we could do today is actually kind of go back and fill in a lot of the gaps slash add in a little bit more details about what I was talking about yesterday, because I thought that was some interest and I'm happy to kind of oblige. Also, because I was doing some literature search at 4 a.m. and realized that there are quite a bit of literature in axions and how substructure is actually really, really important for axion experiments. Like, these are just the ones that I kind of stumbled upon. So it's good to kind of have a deeper understanding of the current state of things in terms of clustering, in terms of dark matter substructure. Okay, so basically what we need to do is understand the dark matter substructure. So the reason that we're actually able to do that now is because there has been a lot of evolution in terms of cosmological simulations. In particular, in the past about 10 years or so, before then, we really had dark matter-only simulations, right? Where basically we have some gravity and particles and that we teach about gravity and we kind of let them collapse. However, more recently, we've been able to kind of go beyond and include what we call baryonic physics. So for example, right now, we can actually track the gas, and in particular, the gas temperature, which is the map that you see right now. And this gas temperature is key in star formation, so we can actually track where stars actually form in more realistic environments. And in particular, we can also track gas metallicity, which is also gives us track, it like keeps track of the chemical abundances in the stars, which are important in measurements. And finally, we can actually hit and have zoom-in simulations of galaxies that look like the Milky Way. It's been, honestly, it's actually quite recent, in about 2013 to 2015, that zoom-in simulations of galaxies that we were able to actually simulate stable disks, you know, just like a disk of the Milky Way, spiral arms. These are all quite difficult. So in parallel to this advancement, we actually have Gaia that I talked about yesterday, and I wanted to show you what a map from Gaia actually looks like. So Gaia, with the billions of stars, we can actually kind of for the first time have grasp at the kinematics of a very large chunk of the stars in the Milky Way. And for example, we can take their proper motion measurements of a very small subset of about 90 million, and we can move that forward in time over the next 800,000 years, and we would actually see how the stars are gonna move. This is extremely important because it really tells us about the structure of the Milky Way and how, and in particular, what I'm interested in personally is how we can go from that to understanding the dark matter in our galaxy. So basically, what we're discussing here is kind of how we can combine the high-resolution simulations and the Gaia data to build the local map of dark matter. Something that I emphasized yesterday, but I'm gonna show you cool videos about today, is that galaxies form hierarchically. Yes, the words were in black on purpose. So galaxies form by merging with other galaxies, just like here. And this is actually one of the videos from one of our higher resolution simulations from the FIRE collaboration. And the fact that galaxies merge this much, actually they do a lot, is that most of the dark matter around us came in through a merger at some point. And that's why we need to figure out a way to actually track it or trace it. So the way that I kind of put this in my mind and kind of like the logic that I try to follow here is that we can build correlations between the stellar and dark matter velocity distributions, and these are, of course, working within some limits. And then that is the number one challenge. And then the second challenge is to identify these stellar structures. And again, this identification is actually highly non-trivial, as I will show you in a bit, because this is the first time that we actually hit, you know, such high level of data, especially in this field. So before that, let's actually talk about correlation between stars and dark matter. It's not like that all the stars track all the dark matter and that's it, we're done. That would have been way too easy. So For that, I will be using simulations from FIRE. FIRE stands for Feedback in Realistic Environments. This is a set of zooming cosmological simulations of the Milky Way. And the video that you're seeing right now is the stellar map of that builds one of our Milky Way-like galaxies. Okay, so you can see that there are a lot of mergers that actually kind of happen, and then things kind of stabilize, and it looks like you have that disk, and it looks like the Milky Way. I ran it quickly pretty on purpose. So what we can do is actually look at the dark matter and stars in the solar neighborhood in our Milky Way, because, you know, it's a simulation. We can actually track all the stars and all the dark matter and figure out where they came coming from, and then we can look at their velocities. So let me actually write this down. Don't worry, I'm not gonna use the board that much today. It's just to kind of clarify the statement that I just made. So if we have, imagine this is our galaxy, we live here. I'm gonna look at the dark matter and the stars that are within a tiny box around the location of the sun. And I'm gonna look at where they come from, like define their origin. Because most things come in from mergers, right? So that's the kind of like the whole idea here. However, I mean, you might say, well, yeah, it's a simulation. You can track all your particles, all the dark matter came, where the dark matter came from and where the stars came from. Yes, it took 13 months of my life to write that code that does that. So it's highly non-trivial, but it works. So let's actually take a look at the velocity distributions of dark matter and stars in here, in this region, based on their origin. Okay? Yes, question.
It's a very basic question.
So please.
I'm just wondering, do we need to assume any particle properties for dark matter for this kind of simulations?
That's a very good question. So it's definitely not. And I should clarify that. So right now, these are all collisionless dark matter or cold dark matter simulations, which means that dark matter does not have any self-interaction, because if it does, actually the plots that I'm going to show you actually change quite a bit. But what I kind of, one of the reasons that I really like this field is it's somewhat agnostic to kind of like the detailed properties of dark matter, because right now we're only looking at the general kind of gravity-induced effects, right? So the dark matter in this particular case could be, for example, something, it could be, you know, 10 to the minus 5 eV, it could be a few TeV. We're really focusing on something that is slightly larger scale and the structure formation part of it. And as long as it's collisionless, so everything is kind of governed by gravity, then all of this holds. Okay? That was a very important question. So we can have, so basically what we're looking at here is a histogram of VR, and then V tangential and the speed distribution of both the dark matter and the stars in one of our simulations. And this is one of the mergers, basically, where the mass of the merger is actually quite high. You can see that in the middle panel it says that it's about 10 to the 11 solar masses. What's the mass of the Milky Way? Anyone? Yeah? That's right, it's 10 to the 12. Okay, so this is a pretty high merger, right? So 10 to the 12 solar masses, that's the mass of the Milky Way. We hit it with something that is 10 to the 11. That's pretty nasty merger. Okay, but the problem is that, not that this is massive, but rather that it came in really late. So you see that the accretion time happened at redshift 0.2. We are right now at redshift 0, and redshift 1 was about 6 billion years ago. So 0.2 is, it's nonlinear, so it's hard for me to do in my mind, but basically it's pretty recent. So now, let's take a look at the velocity distributions. You can see that they are kind of close, but not exactly on top of each other, right? And the reason that they don't really, really overlap is because this merger is quite recent. So here's what happens. So we have basically, actually, I'm gonna keep my Milky Way here, and I'm gonna have this merger where the stars are in here, and then the dark matter halo is about an order of magnitude higher, right? As things kind of fall into my galaxy, we start kind of removing the outer layers, right? So we start kind of like etching out of the dark matter. And because this is more tightly bound. And then at some point, we start actually stripping the stars. When we are stripping the stars at a later stage, we're only kept with the dark matter that is around it, which means that we do expect the dark matter and the stars to actually really, really do a great job of following each other. But this is not really true at the beginning stages, which is why these distributions are not exactly the same. So let's take a look at another merger. And things do look a lot better already, right? So this is got accreted at redshift 0.7. Even the very strange kind of it has two peaks, basically. Radial velocity is very well tracked with both the dark matter and the stars. We keep going with another merger at redshift 0.8. Same thing, it looks pretty good. And then we can go to things that are really, really old, like something that got accreted at redshift 3.7. So this distribution, actually, if you take a very close look, this is what looks like very much like the Maxwell-Boltzmann. And the reason for it is because it came in so long ago that it had really time to virialize and settle down, that it basically ends up giving you more or less a Maxwell-Boltzmann with a circular velocity depending on the galaxy mass. So hopefully, like, the message here is that yes, we can correlate the dark matter and the stars as long as it's not a very, very recent merger. Does that make sense? Yes? No? Maybe? Okay. All right. So now the second part of all of this is really to try to identify these stellar structures, right? Because if we can, then we can kind of build them up and build the dark matter from there. So the way that I like to think about it is through a tree or a genealogy of the Milky Way, okay? So basically, I have the Milky Way in the bottom, and I'm trying to build all the different mergers that happen in the Milky Way. Because having a deep understanding of this is, on its own, an astrophysics, actually a very important question in astrophysics, which is what we call galaxy formation. But also because if we have all the different components, we can kind of put them together and try to build a detailed view of the dark matter velocity distribution. Okay? So how is this gonna go? Well, I'm gonna have time. So basically this, on the bottom, I have like my Milky Way, the way that it looks like today. On the top, I'm gonna put in the very, very old mergers, so things that happened a very, very long time ago. Potentially they could have virialized by now, who knows. And very, very close in the bottom, we have something that is very, very recent mergers. Okay, so things that are still kind of falling into our galaxy. And to be able to do that, let me define the different merging stages. So we have a merging galaxy. This is what I'm showing here, so it's this guy. This is initially a merging galaxy, it's just falling into our Milky Way right now. And then it turns into a stream, like we showed yesterday, and like we discussed. That's like the first kind of stage of disruption. And then it turns into what we call debris flow, which is that spatially it looks very, very coherent and you don't really see anything. But kinematically, it still has some very specific distribution. So I'm gonna go through examples of all of these just to kind of build an intuition and have an understanding of, you know, what does the Milky Way actually look like right now. So let's start with a merging galaxy. Can anybody name a galaxy that is currently falling into the Milky Way? Yeah? Andromeda, yes. It's, to be fair, it's equal masses, so we're falling into each other. I was looking for something smaller, but yes, it's true. So in 5 billion years, we're gonna hit Andromeda, by the way. So if you wanna stick around for that, that's gonna be cool. Anything else? Yeah? Thank you, the Magellanic Cloud. All right, so which is the next? Thanks, Cassidy. Okay, so let's start by zooming out of the galaxy. So that's the sun. Move out, we have planets, we have the disk of the Milky Way, and we are currently being hit by something called the Large Magellanic Cloud. So the Large Magellanic Cloud is, and actually there are two. That's the Large Magellanic Cloud, and the small one on the there is the Small Magellanic Cloud. So these two galaxies are falling into the Milky Way. The Large Magellanic Cloud is what we call on first infall. So it's just kind of just coming into our galaxy. And it's interesting because its mass is about a tenth of the mass of the Milky Way. And the fact that it's present is actually changing the gravitational potential of the Milky Way and affecting a lot of our measurements right now. So for example, it's affecting the way the streams form, and it is kind of, it actually, there has been some studies that shows that some dark matter particles from the Large Magellanic Cloud that are very, very high speeds could be actually in our going through our detectors right now. So it's very important to have for dark matter detection. So that's the Large Magellanic Cloud. It's coming in recently, which is why it is in the bottom. It hasn't really hit us yet, but getting close. And it's not really the only one, because we have quite a few dwarf galaxies. They're currently orbiting the Milky Way, and some of them are getting disrupted on the way. Particularly, for example, I'll talk about different examples later, but we have actually quite a few of those. So the Large Magellanic Cloud is just an example. It is the most massive one, which is why kind of we usually take that the most into account. Okay, so then we have the stage of streams, which is the same video I showed yesterday. As things fall, they start getting disrupted, right? And then as they get disrupted, we can actually see them in our telescopes. In particular, we saw the field of streams, which we discussed yesterday. And this is about this is an image from the Sloan Digital Sky Survey back in 2007. Actually, a postdoc in my group, Nora Ship, is working on updated field of streams right now, which is pretty cool. So I can't wait to show you the next time. I'll show you more updated field of streams. Basically, the colors are by distance, by the way. So some of these streams, as I mentioned yesterday, are globular clusters, which means that are a collection of stars that are born within the Milky Way. So kind of like you have a hot pocket of gas that cools down, and then that forms a bunch of stars together, right, that are bound together. However, the reason that that's not interesting from a dark matter perspective is because I think almost by definition, the globular clusters does not really need dark matter to be bound because it's self-bound by itself. However, dwarf galaxies or any other galaxy does need dark matter and a pretty sizable chunk of that actually to be bound. So these globular clusters like GD1 stream, the Orphan stream, and PAL5 are streams, yes, but they're not going to be part of our story. So they're not going to be part of the genealogy of the Milky Way. And the way that we can distinguish them is by studying the chemical abundances of these stars. Basically, how much iron these stars have can tell us if they are born out of a globular cluster or a dwarf galaxy. And I'm happy to discuss that later. But so Sagittarius is the galaxy that I talked about yesterday. And it is a dwarf galaxy that is merging into the Milky Way, and it's actually on third infall, so a few wraps past the Large Magellanic Cloud. And in particular, we can actually see detailed image of what happened. So Sagittarius came in about 8 billion years ago and started getting disrupted as it goes through our disk. It kind of went on a first passage, second passage, 1.9 billion years later. Million years ago, and right now it looks like this, so in third passage. So you can see that, this is not, it is an artistic rendition, but it's not exaggerated of how big Sagittarius is and how big the Sagittarius stream is. So you can actually see it kind of covering a good chunk of the sky with a good telescope. Can't really see it by your eyes, but this is interesting because it can help us actually, yes? With Sagittarius, Right. Have we detected, for example, the... I don't think we have. Definitely there has not been, or at least not that I'm aware of, like a particular detection of like the supermassive black hole in the middle of Sagittarius or in the middle of the Large Magellanic Cloud. Some massive galaxies like that, I think they should have one, but I don't think there have been detailed studies about actually detecting it. Because we really, I mean, they're really hard to see. So I know about studies that have seen like, you know, Sagittarius A star, ours, and then other ones with bigger galaxies. But yeah, smaller ones, I'm not sure. Yeah. So there are, there's something called the splashback radius, which is where if you have a merger of galaxies, sometimes you have, like, if you have, well, let me use this, a big galaxy and a small galaxy here, as it's getting disrupted, sometimes you have, like, the black hole in one of the, kind of, the smaller galaxies actually gets knocked off the trajectory just because of the gravitational field, because, like, yeah, as things kind of get disrupted. So not all of them keep them. And we definitely see that a lot happening in simulations of large, like Illustris, they have actually quite a bit of literature on splashback radii. But yeah, I haven't encountered literature about these. Mm-hmm. Okay, so that's what Sagittarius is doing. And in that case, it actually came in a little bit earlier than the Large Magellanic Cloud. That's why I kind of put it a little bit higher on my sheet. And then we can go even further into debris flow. So things I imaged in even longer ago. And this is where the Gaia Enceladus sausage look comes into play. As we discussed yesterday, it came in about 6 to 10 billion years ago with a mass somewhere between 1 and 10% of the Milky Way. So I'm going to show like the plots of the velocities. If you take a look at this, can you see where the sausage is? Especially when I call it sausage. OK, I wish I had a pointer. Maybe I don't. Anyways, so the VR VFi plot that I'm showing there, it's going to be a plot that I'm going to show quite a bit. So this is in galactocentric coordinates, right? So this is the radial direction. This is Vphi. You can think of it as spherical or cylindrical. It looks about the same because we're very close to the disk anyway. So we have a bunch of stars that are kind of clumped up here. Right, and this is about 200 kilometers a second. And you can see them in that plot. Okay. Oh, thank you. Amazing. Thank you. Here we go. Okay, so those stars. What do you guys think those stars are? Yes, exactly. Random stars going around the galaxy. That's basically what we call disk stars. Yes. So the sun is one of them, right? Because the sun is co-rotating around the galaxy about 200 kilometers a second. What you can see in that figure is actually like this haze of a bunch of stars that are here. So these are the sausage stars. In particular, they have pretty high densities here and here. So they have a pretty high velocity in radial direction. And that's how they were noticed, basically. Like, I think this is actually a plot that I got from the discovery paper, from the Bulukarov et al. And they looked at different chemical abundances, don't worry about that. But basically, Vasily Bulukarov actually just saw that there is this big haze that has pretty high radial velocities back in 2018 and was like, there is something there, I'm gonna call it the sausage. If you discover something, please don't call it after food. So, I forgot that. So then we can actually go about modeling these distribution. And again, it has like that double peak in the radial velocity, which, yes.
Is the shape of the distribution interesting in the out-of-plane direction as well?
Oh, in VZ.
Yes.
Basically. No, actually, it has an average of zero in VZ.
Okay.
Yeah, I know. Kind of insane. Some other things actually have interesting VZ, but good question. So we can actually model the radial velocity of the Gaia sausage, and it kind of reminds us that in simulations we can kind of see that we can actually kind of see that there are mergers similar, not exactly the same, because basically simulations are not trying to reproduce exactly the Milky Way, because every galaxy has its own merger history. But what we're trying to understand from simulations is really the physics. Basically, if we have a merger, does it correlate? Because do the velocities correlate, for example? Especially if we have this type of merger that has like very high kind of peaks at radial velocities of positive and negative. And the reason that they do that is because you can think of it as if you have a sphere and you're kind of throwing an arrow through it, and then it kind of, the arrow does come back, that as it goes in, you'll have a spike in negative VR, and as it comes out, you have a spike in positive VR. Yes?
Sorry. So I'm trying to understand what, like, obviously there's this question of how well do they correlate, and you're trying to do this in the simulations. We discussed this a little bit yesterday. What
yeah.
kind of things would mess up this correlation?
Mm-hmm.
So one would be, like, if the dark matter was self-interacting.
Yep.
Another is, I could imagine if the just dark matter and stellar masses are very different, right? Like the mass of a dark matter particle might be a GeV, the mass of a star might be a solar mass. In the simulations that are being run,
yeah.
what are the like effective dark matter particle masses that you guys have there? What is the granularity of dark matter?
Oh, yeah, so these are large. What we call particles, zoom-in simulations are actually pretty large. In the simulations that we have right now, for this one, the star particle is 7,000 solar masses, 7,700 actually, oh. and it's 34,000 for the dark matter particle mass. And you have them by a factor of 5 just to kind of make sure
so
that.
What,
yeah.
like if you're doing a CDM simulation
yes.
here, where both of these things are collisionless and
yes.
they both start in the same place,
yeah.
what could possibly make them be decorrelated at the end? Is it that they have different initial density distributions, like the stars are clustered close to the center and the dark matter
exactly.
is?
Exactly, yeah.
Okay.
It's just that, and that's the bit that you have to take care of. Like, that's the bit that made all of this quite challenging, and you kind of really you need to make sure that you're further down the merger history, yeah.
I see, okay, yeah. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay.
Oh, sorry, can you explain again the positive and negative VR? The
oh, sure.
The just gave?
Yeah. So basically, imagine that this is my galaxy in galactocentric spherical coordinates, like this. And then I have kind of some what we call highly eccentric orbits. So something that kind of does like this, and kind of like this. So as it comes in, you're going to have a spike in negative VR. This is as the object is coming in. As it comes out the other side of the orbit, you're going to have positive VR. This is different, for example, from orbits that look a little bit more like, you know, circles, where you would actually you're not going to have that much of VR, you're going to have this, like, kind of a distribution like this. Does that make sense? I think there was a question in the back.
From the simulations, can you tell how likely it is that one of these mergers would have happened that looks like the thing on the right?
You mean if this is the final distribution?
I mean, presumably you run these simulations a bunch of times, and they kind of sometimes look like the thing on the left, but not always.
Yeah.
So how likely is it that it looks like the thing on the right?
Oh, I see. Okay. Yeah. So we do have multiple simulations. Unfortunately, for this size, we actually only have 13 because each one is about 20, 25 million CPU hours. And basically, But actually, yeah. So these are for the zoom-in simulations. We have large box simulations that have lower resolution, so you can simulate, you know, many more galaxies. And we're working on a paper right now with Dylan Folsom from Princeton and Mariangela Lasanti. And basically, we're trying to kind of track the occurrence of the fraction of mergers that look like this, really. And I think From the preliminary plot that he showed me last week, I think it was small. Well, we were trying to figure out how many of the galaxies have a large Magellanic Cloud and a sausage-like merger, and I think it was about 20% or less. There is, basically, most galaxies have a lot of these mergers, so the fact that before this discovery, kind of like we thought that the Milky Way was just very quiet and boring was like, there were so many papers of, is the Milky Way unusually quiet? What happened? Now we see that there is a lot of like, the kind of a lot of mergers in the history of the Milky Way that matches a little bit more of our simulations. But the exact one to kind of get exactly in the scenario, yeah, it's not the most common thing.
Thanks.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So then we're gonna put the Gaia Enceladus, or the Gaia sausage, all the way up there. It's because it is a slightly older merger that hit kind of debris flow. And of course, the question that one can ask is, what else happens in this tree, right? These three, we can actually kind of sort of just see and fill in. And that's kind of what happened. The Large Magellanic Cloud, you can actually see from the southern hemisphere. Like, if it's very, very dark, you can actually see it, which is pretty incredible. The Sagittarius stream, you can't see it by eye, but with some nice telescope, you can see the overdensity. Then the Gaia sausage, that's true, you can't see anything, but with some good velocity measurement, and it's because it also contributes about 60% of the local stars that are not from the disk, so it really dominates pretty much everything, you can kind of squint and see it. But there is so much squinting can do, right? So what I kind of advocate for now is a lot of like the automation of the identification of these stellar structures. And of course, things kind of get a little bit hairy and more difficult when we do that. But let's kind of look at some different ways that one can do it. First, we can train on simulations to distinguish what we call accreted stars from in-situ stars. So that's a lot of jargon. But basically, there are, in the Milky Way, these disk stars that we're talking about. These are also called in situ, which is born in the Milky Way. So these stars are born out of the gas of the Milky Way. So we have the gas in the Milky Way, it radiates, it's highly collisional and highly dissipative. So it kind of, to preserve angular momentum, as it loses energy, it kind of flattens out into the pancake, right? And stars that are born out of that gas will kind of keep with that angular momentum. They will be in more or less circular orbits, just like the sun. Quite boring, nothing really interesting going on. However, other stars are coming in through mergers, right? And these are the ones from a dark matter perspective. These are the ones that you actually need to be paying attention to, because these are the ones that will be tracing the dark matter. However, again, because things are quite difficult, accreted stars are only 1% of the local stars. And the reason for it is because we live right in the disk, right? Like, so we are surrounded by stars that are born in the disk of the Milky Way. And very few of them actually came in from somewhere else and kind of settled nearby, right? So this is kind of gives you the needle in a haystack situation, and you try to find those accreted stars. And one way you can do it is, of course, using machine learning, where you can teach a neural net to distinguish cats from dogs, and then ask it if it's, is that a cat or a dog? Honestly, I didn't know. I was waiting for the end of this video the first time. Apparently it was a dog. I'm like, I was squinting, okay. So we can do this by building synthetic surveys of simulations and then comparing them to Gaia. In a lot of talks, I actually ask people to vote if which one they thought was a real one, but I think it was a bit too easy. Specifically, if you're paying attention, you can see that this is a Large Magellanic Cloud and this is a Small Magellanic Cloud. So sometimes I actually even hid them. Just, anyways, I have my fun. Okay, so basically, this top one is what we call a synthetic survey. It is basically what would Gaia see if we lived in one of the simulations, specifically the one that I showed you, how it formed in the early video, okay? So we can do that. And then that 7,000 solar mass particle, we actually kind of like break it following the stellar mass function into much smaller particles, and we have kernels and all the fun stuff. And we have to take into account the Gaia selection function, a lot of cool things. Anyways, we end up with synthetic surveys that we can actually use. So what we could do is train on the simulations, because in the simulation, we can kind of figure out which one is the accreta star, which one is not. And then we can go ahead and label the Gaia stars. So the question is binary. Is this star accreted or not? But we're not really training on pictures anymore. We're actually training on the kinematics that we talked about yesterday, right? So yesterday we said that Gaia has 5D kinematics, parallax, 2 angular positions, and 2 velocities and proper motions. So that's what we do here. And then we can kind of build an accreted catalog, and we did do it, and basically plot it and look at what happened. So this is the accreted catalog that we did out of Gaia DR2. So this is from back in 2019. And you can kind of see, you can see the Gaia saucers by eye, right? Yeah? Maybe? We said it was here, right? Oh, the disk? Good question. This is an accreted catalog, and its main job was to get rid of those stars, because those are the stars born in the Milky Way. And it did a pretty good job, right? Does that make sense, what we're trying to do? Yeah? Okay. So you can kind of see it. It means that it's working, which is good. Of course, you can kind of throw in some GMM, so gaseous mixture model, to figure out all the different structures, and they all look up. And then you can actually sometimes see new stuff that you get to name. So this is Nyx, the Greek goddess of the night, which I thought was particularly fitting. And Nyx, we don't know if it's a merger or just perturbance, and we're currently kind of still working out on what's up with it. But this way, we can actually build, kind of try to keep building the genealogy of the Milky Way. Of course, it's a lot more difficult because you see an overdensity and you're like, okay, is that really accreted, or did something hit the disk and cause the disk stars to actually perturb and get out of orbits, which happens, and then you end up having to learn a lot of dynamics and realize that the Milky Way is a bit of a mess. Something else that we could do is actually clustering. So the previous method of training really does rely on information from simulations, right? So if you want to be agnostic about the simulation and not use them, you can actually just use clustering, which is, you know, just try to group stars together that are like over densities in particular spaces. Of course, that's difficult because you don't have true labels. You don't really know if you're doing right thing or not. You can apply it on simulations to kind of test it out, but it's still, basically every method has its difficulties. Thing is, this is the state of the art of the field, which I personally find very upsetting. So first of all, let's kind of try to define these. So this is the angular momentum, LZ, and this is the energy of stars. So the reason that we usually plot a lot of stars in this space right here, it's because when something merges, if you assume that the potential is not changing and the potential is axisymmetric, then there are constants of motion. So as they're falling in, they would kind of occupy a space in energy versus angular momentum that doesn't really change. This is not very much true, of course, because the potential of the Milky Way is changing, but this is kind of gets closer than trying to figure out overdensities in position space. So out of Gaia DR2, and actually this one had Gaia DR2 and a different survey called H3 survey, cross-matched. So basically here are the different stars, and then they got clustered mainly by eye into these different structures, right? And of course, these are not just like, it's not just out of this one plot. They looked at, I think, 8 different dimensions, and basically in position space, velocities, and actions, and chemical abundances. But at the end of the day, there was a lot of staring and boxing, and this is what we ended up with. So a lot of it is true, a lot of these structures are there. However, I just don't find, I find that highly subjective, which is why kind of a lot of my recent work is just on a crusade against this. The GSE is the Gaia Sausage Enceladus, which is what the Gaia Sausage is called right now, just to kind of make peace with the two competing teams that discovered it, the Sausage and the Enceladus, so it's GSE. And it's right here because it has zero V-phi. So the x-axis is the angular momentum along Z, which has V-phi. Anyways, so one thing that we could do is actually use clustering, right? So this is an example of just a random data set generated. And our eyes are actually the OG neural net. We're pretty good at clustering. However, we're good at clustering in two dimensions. And then when things kind of get out of hand, like, we just can't do it. So for example, we can cluster this. And what you want, because the, when you kind of go on sklearn, there are like so many clustering algorithms. And you're like, OK, which one do I pick, right? And what you want is something that really satisfies the properties that you want in a clustering algorithm and they're specific to your data set. For example, in this particular data set, we can use something called k-means clustering, like this. And you can already see it by eye there. You're like, my brain would not have done that, you know? Where, for example, this brown kind of structure is going onto two, the blue, they look like different ones. We can also use, alternatively, something called HDB scan. That seems to be doing a lot of what your brain would do in these particular cases, right? So the cool thing about HDB scan, which obviously is the one that I ended up using, is because there are, it can handle this type of data where you have different sizes because you don't know how big your clusters are. It has arbitrary shapes. Some of them could be like intertwined, banana looking, you know, clusters. There is some noise, as in that you end up with stars that are just like in the background. Either they got kicked out because of the inner black hole, which happens, hypervelocity stars, or they just don't belong to anything, or they just got disrupted just because it's a very early merger that got shredded completely. And something that deals with different densities. So something that we really wanted to do, and my student Shawio actually ended up doing, is build a robust clustering. Robust clustering means for basically this is one of the first papers, really, to take into account the fact that we have errors in measurements. And it's really annoying because computer scientists are great at writing amazing algorithms, but errors are not the thing that they deal with at all, slash ever. So we kind of have to figure it out. so here is the Gaia EDR3 early data release 3 proper motions with Gaia EDR2 revelocities. Anyways, I'm happy to discuss these details later. But basically, you can see here that this is the number of stars per bit. It's a lot of stars. This is the energy. This is J-phi or LZ. This is the angular momentum. And in terms of VR, V-phi that we talked about here, this is the stars. And you can see, so the reason that this is negative is just because the disk is negative. So there is a minus sign compared to the other plot that we talked about earlier. But basically, you can see that the disk is orders of magnitude higher in density that you have to kind of get rid of. But also, now you can actually see, with this data set, you can kind of see the Gaia sausage like really clear as day. You don't have to do anything to see it. So now what we're looking for really is, what are the next smaller things that are around here? So in what we did in our work, actually, we looked at this, we wanted to only find stable clusters. Stable clusters means that the clusters that are always found, even if you vary across, like a new resample across the errors in velocities and positions of the different stars. Because a lot of the clusters actually disappear when you do that. That doesn't mean this is a complete set. So this is probably a subset of the real clusters, but this is definitely the most stable and the most robust. So the red stars here in the same panels that I was showing earlier actually are the ones that always kept getting clustered, definitely kept getting clustered at least 40 times through 100 realizations, right? So what we ended up doing is basically running clustering twice. cluster the first time, pick out the stars that always get clustered, and then only focus on clustering them. Also 100 times. Anyways. So you can see that a lot of the stars actually move a lot. And actually, oh, I forgot to add this, but yeah, Xiaowei actually made a kind of a GIF of like, if you once you resample them, cross arrows, and you can see things moving. So then you can actually use a clustering algorithm, or HDB scan in this particular case, and you can actually see different structures. For example, these two here, well, this kind of yellow and green, that's the Gaia sausage. But you can see it kind of is divided throughout multiple, and there is something in the literature that actually kind of attributes this to different structures, and other people are like, no, it's just one. Anyways, we're still trying to figure that out. Yes?
So just to understand, when you say you're resampling, you mean that you are jittering each star's position and velocity data from Gaia, you know, by whatever distribution of errors Gaia data has.
Yes. So basically, you resample within the. Basically, you have like you assume Gaussian errors, and we hope that that's a valid assumption. In the 6D phase space, in positions and velocities, and you resample 100 times out of that Gaussian distribution to figure out where your star is, and you kind of like your stars actually do move a little bit, and some of them, and that's how you lose a lot of the clusters. Yes.
And can you give some sense? So I would guess that the angular positions of the stars are very accurate, but I would guess that the velocity.
Oh yeah, the position
in
the sky.
Accurate.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes. Yes.
So like, what are the kind of percent level errors that we're talking about here?
Yeah.
Parameters.
So the most inaccurate thing that we actually have to deal with is distances. And that's because we measure parallaxes. And so you actually, when you're dealing with this data set, the first thing is that you have to make a cut on your parallax. So you're only looking at data that has, I think, 10% error or less in parallax. But basically, and then there are some quality cuts that you kind of apply later on. And the problem is that distance errors kind of propagate into velocity errors. And also in the position errors. So you end up with velocity errors of about, I think most of them we checked, less than 5% errors. But again, this is assuming the quality cuts that you already have in the beginning. But that's enough to kind of, so for the big clusters, that doesn't really change the story, and that's why they're always very stable. But for, there are a lot of small clusters that are found in the literature that have like only 20 stars or 100 stars, and they are like, oh, that's something there, and then you're like, is it really? And these very small changes actually can kind of make such clusters dissipate completely.
Can you give some sense of what fraction of Gaia data gets thrown out by just those initial quality cuts that you're talking about?
Oh, yes.
Is that
so,
a large fraction?
When we did it with Gaia DR2, and we started with 7 million that had 6D, the quality cuts actually dropped us down to, I think, 5.8 million. For Gaia DR3, we started with 33 million. I think 28 million stuck around. So it wasn't actually a much better data set the second time around. Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay, I'm just taking a look at the time. Okay, so basically we can look at these robust clusters. The next thing that we want to do is really try to understand what they are and then get the velocity distributions of dark matter out of them to build kind of a more concrete picture. Something else that we could do is automate stream finding for a lot of other reasons, but basically, well, streams are cool, but also because they can tell us about the smallest subhalo size. And the way that we can do this is by using something called Via Machina, which is really, it's an anomaly detection that we use. So we can kind of start with a data set that looks like this. The streaks are just a feature of the initial of Gaia DR2 that got better with Gaia DR3. And then you kind of apply it, and you actually can see something just pop out quite directly, which is pretty interesting. And actually, this thing is GD1 stream, which I showed very, very early on. this is kind of what has been found in the literature, and this is our work and how we found it. And actually, it has some of the different structures in it. And in particular, for example, like, there are like lower density gaps here and here, and these kind of were very interesting because the question is, what can explain that gap in a stream? There are usually multiple astrophysics answers, which is like if you pass next to the bar, or if you have like chaotic orbits and disk and all that fun stuff. But for something like GD1, it's actually pretty far up away from the disk, so it's 10 kiloparsecs away. And because of that, it's very unlikely that it got hit by anything. So then what it can do is actually a dark matter clump could have passed by and kind of pulled some of the stars away with it. And kind of that basically drops the density of stars in particular places, which is very interesting because that kind of can tell us about the size of these dark subhalos and dark clumps that we can get, and that kind of tells us about the power spectrum of the initial dark matter. Yeah. Oh, no, sorry. This is just for pictures. So basically, we use the two positions, the two proper motions, and the magnitudes and colors. No, sorry. There are other information that went in there. Yes. It would be pretty difficult to get it. That would be pretty amazing, right? Yeah, I know. I know, right? Like, we can make magic appear. No, that's not it. Okay, so let me kind of wrap up towards the end by saying that we can kind of put all of this together, which is like the whole point, and kind of leverage this correlation and the identification of these new structures to build the velocity distribution. So this is actually work that we've done based on the Gaia sausage only. So this is the speed distribution that we talked about yesterday. And it has different lines. And blue is the substructure, and this is the Gaia sausage. In red is what we call the stellar halo, and this is basically the stars that have merged in a very, very long time ago. And we can put them together to end up with a velocity distribution like this, which is quite different from this Tannen halo model, which is in dashed gray. So that's the Maxwell-Boltzmann that we discussed yesterday. However, this does not include some of the more recent smaller mergers and smaller structures that are very close. We're trying to update that. However, we can't do that until we understand the nature of all of these clumps and where they come from, and things can get messy, but it is what it is. And what we can do, ideally in the end, is to kind of have the speed distribution of dark matter being two components, basically coming from the stellar halo and the substructure with, you know, fractions, and the fractions are not the same as the fractions of stars, as we discussed yesterday, so which means that we have to use some relation to figure out the mass-to-light ratio, how much dark matter each merger has brought in, so we can rescale things properly. And then we can find the final distribution, and which we kind of put together. So basically kind of like the big, big, big goal over the next few years really is to kind of try to get a speed distribution like this, coming from all of these different mergers and all of the small things that we can get, well, all the smaller structures that we can get out of Gaia. And this will be extremely important for WIMP searches, for axion searches, for everything, to kind of get something very empirical that actually tells us about what the Milky Way looks like right now. So let me just end with that. Thank you.
Thanks. Really, really helpful talk here. So in the red and the blue here,
yeah,
these look like order one related. You know, there's about the same total. But there's only 1% of stars, you said, around the disk. So why is there this big difference? This is just because these smaller structures are much more inefficient at forming stars in the first place?
Oh, no, actually, it's because what we're looking for, so I think, yeah, sometimes that's actually, I really need to write it down better. So you start with total stars around the Milky Way. Mm-hmm. 1% is accreted, and 99% are the disk. Or in situ, right? So these disk in-situ stars have nothing to do with dark matter because they were born out of the gas of the Milky Way, so they will be tracking the gas of the Milky Way, right? So no dark matter. These guys actually tell us a lot about the dark matter, and in particular, actually, let me write it all. Sorry, I'm just remembering more things. Okay, so we have the halo. This is old stuff. The guy sausage. Smaller structures that we want to see with Gaia. Dark subhalos. So what I'm showing you in this figure is the first two, right? What we want to do next is add those guys. And that's, we kind of have a way of doing that. This is the big mystery slash the more complicated part because it doesn't have any tracers. In simulations, we think that it's about 20-ish percent of the whole thing, but that depends on the simulation and the different merger history. So what we're trying to do is actually get that. So I'm showing you these two, and they are both comparable sizes to each other is what we're saying.
So if I were to do like a very poor man's version of this analysis and just say like make a hard cut on metallicity, like stellar metallicity or something like that, which mm-hmm. is a proxy for like yeah. formation early. You're saying I could if I cut on only things with really low metallicity,
yeah.
then that should give me roughly like two different order one components, one of which is yeah. this kind of red, one of which is
basically yes. That's right.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thank you. Right, so I guess I just have a very general question of how well we can trust this result in a model independent way. For example, if we have wave-like dark matter, mm-hmm. The correlation between dark matter velocity and stellar structure might be very different. I don't know anything about that. So
that's something that we are actually working on. So this holds for, you know, for dark matter that behaves more like particle and it's collisionless and everything, but then if you go very, very low, you end up in the fuzzy dark matter world in astrophysics, and then the equations that you kind of like govern the evolution of these simulations actually are different, in which case you have to solve like Schrodinger 1D. We're working on building a suite of simulations that does focus on this fuzzy dark matter, and then we're gonna work through like the correlations and figure out actually what happens and what doesn't. But this is, of course, for the very low mass, yes.
Right, so as far as I can tell, the result here is very general for cold dark matter, is that
yes.
correct?
Yes, okay, that's thank exactly you. Right.
Any further question? Not then, let's thank Lynn again.
Thank you.